In the late autumn of 1968, Dorian Bond was tasked with travelling to Yugoslavia to deliver cigars and film stock to the legendary Hollywood director Orson Welles. The pair soon struck up an unlikely friendship, and Welles offered Bond the role of his personal assistant, as well as a part in his next movie. No formal education could prepare him for the journey that would ensue. Now, I have on the line here the one and only Dorian Bond. Good day to you, Dorian.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And now, what a fantastic opportunity. And I mean, I'm in awe because, I mean, Orson Welles was one of my idols. And of course, as I say, we all know those of us of age of Citizen Kane and all the other stuff he did. But he had a fascinating life. It's a fascinating memoir you've written. Follows the two of you across Europe in the late 60s, where you visited beautiful cities and so on. So tell us a little bit about your experiences. But what did you feel when he first offered you the job?
Well, it was amazing because I'd left university and gone to film school because I was keen to go into the film business in some shape or form. And of course, at film school in London, which was then in it was called the London School of Film Technique.
Yes.
And it was in a grassy ex-warehouse in Covent Garden when Covent Garden was still a market, exactly.
Sure, sure.
And I really didn't enjoy it, or I wasn't enjoying it. And then it's all in the book. I met some friends, or had supper with some friends, and one of them said, oh, I've just been to Yugoslavia to take some film from Mr. Orson Welles. So I said, oh, my goodness, you know, next time they ring you, could you recommend me? So anyway, cut a long story short, that's what happened. Miracle, miracle. So when I got there, I never told him I was at film school.
Okay.
And I never told him that, you know, I loved Citizen Kane and all the rest of it. I just sort of did my job and ran around being helpful. And at the end of it, after about, I think it was 3 or 4 days, he suddenly said, you know, do you want to work for me, boy? So I thought, wow, yes, please.
That was probably a very clever move, if I may say so, because I don't know whether he sort of into sycophants. So the moment you arrived, you said, oh, I loved all your films. Oh, I'm at film school.
Yes.
You know, you probably would have thought, oh, God, here's another one.
Exactly. It would be quite boring, wouldn't it? Yeah,
yes.
Another cinema buff.
Yeah. So he offered you the job of his personal assistant. I mean, what was your first reaction to that?
I was delighted, obviously, and chuffed a bit. And then we met back in London, and it all went from there. But I mean, there was no money involved. I mean, I basically worked, you know, hand to mouth, and he used to hand me large dollar bills occasionally, and that's how it went. But at that age, you're not interested in, you're not paying a mortgage or, you know, just having an interesting time. That was the main thing.
Well, why not, indeed? I mean, good gracious me. I mean, the opportunity to actually be that close to somebody who's that famous. And, of course, also, I suppose a lot of his amazing sort of aura must have come sort of rubbed off on you to some extent, do you think?
Well, yes, hopefully. I mean, though I say it modestly, I'm a reasonably knowledgeable chap, and I was quite knowledgeable even at an early age. And so, because of my father, we used to talk about history and philosophy and sport and you name it. We had a very wide range of subjects. And, of course, Welles, you know, the last thing really he wanted to talk about was filmmaking, and he wanted to talk about, you know, politics or art or architecture or, you know, or beautiful women, whatever they fancy at the time.
Well, I mean, it says here in that lead into the article in the Sunday Times, burning $100 bills, exposing himself to nuns, gorging, womanizing, and name-dropping like a man possessed in this riveting memoir of him. I mean, Dorian, I mean, you must have seen a heck of a lot of things. Did it shock you?
Yes, a bit. I mean, the exposing himself to nuns, I don't know where that came from, but...
I've heard it as well.
But the $100 bill thing was that he was in a fury with a poor waiter in Harry's Bar in Venice. In fact, he made amends in the end, or I did, actually. But he suddenly got out of his pram very seriously. And, of course, he was this enormous man with this massive voice, and he was tall and he was big, and in every sense of the word. So when he bellowed at you from about 3 inches, it was absolutely terrifying.
No, a voice that would actually sort of literally sort of go 100 yards, and you would know exactly immediately who it was.
Exactly. I think at one point he was known as The Voice in America.
He was.
Years ago.
Mm. Yeah. Now, obviously, he said he loved politics, loved talking about art, and some of the people you must have met, I've said presumably with him, famous people. Can you name a few?
Yes, a few. Yes, and we met Faye Dunaway and Marcello Mastroianni, who were having a big affair at that time in Italy, and Lawrence Harvey and. John Houston and all sorts of...
It's all
in my riveting book. It was an extraordinary experience, and he was a remarkable man. I mean, he wasn't really just a film director or just an actor. He was a complete, man...
Yeah.
Man for all seasons, to coin a phrase.
Well, because he achieved such an incredible, massive success in very early life. I mean, the unfortunate thing about that was, of course, Citizen Kane was such a masterpiece. You know, they say, well, the only way is up, but in many instances, of course, it was the only way down, because he must have torched through an awful lot of money over the years, and other people's money to boot.
No, exactly. It was unfortunate in a sense, he was a big stage actor on Broadway and made a big name for himself in New York initially. And then, as they did in those days, Hollywood, would summon you, and he was given, a good budget and a complete free hand. It's very, very rare. And of course, he made the film, and then it got the opposition from William Randolph Hearst, who sort of owned all the newspaper outlets at that time. But, But he had this reputation of being profligate with money, but, in many ways, he never actually was given any proper money to make a film,
sure.
in a sense. If there had been, dare I say it, people like Harvey Weinstein around, these kind of independent producers, then, who would back an idea, he would have been much better suited to more this day and age,
I'm very sort of taken by what you've just said there, because I mean Weinstein has been a very naughty boy, as they used to say in Life of Brian, but of course very seriously a naughty boy. At the same time, of course, he did champion the independent of films. Would we know of Tarantino if it wasn't for him? But going back to Orson Welles, he struggled to raise funds to make films, because he had to have total control. And, of course, this was always a frightening thing for investors.
Exactly. But as you say, nowadays it has happened a bit more, particularly if you get an independent producer who's quite strong behind you, somebody like Sam Spiegel or something, maybe he could have done more and better things. But you're right, it was a downhill slope really from that high point of Citizen Kane, sadly.
Well, I mean, obviously you've got an awful lot to sort of talk about. I mean, in your book you talk about reminiscing about Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt and characteristic acerbic wit featuring tales about famous movie stars such as Laurence Olivier, Marlene Dietrich, of course, he's been, and Steve McQueen. Yes. A fresh insight into both the man and his filmmaking, as it describes your book. I mean, it's just the opportunity to actually spend that time. How long were you actually sort of in his presence, shall I say?
Well, I was with him for a couple of years, and the thing was that it was a very intimate time, because, people have... Simon Callow, the English actor, has written a very worthy and sort of academic biography of Orson Welles in three massive volumes.
Yes.
Doing all the research and all the rest of it. By the way, I've never been consulted, but that's another
story.
The thing was that, I used to have breakfast with him every day and lunch with him every day. He'd disappear in the late afternoon. I wouldn't see him till the following morning. But it was a very sort of intimate experience, if you like. And it was absolutely wonderful. And, of course, the other thing I'm sidetracking now. His great experience of Europe, he was this great aficionado of European things, wasn't he?
Indeed,
he lived
in
Madrid for a long period of time. And, he had a film company. It was called Rapama Films, which was, Rome, Paris and Madrid, which were his three big cities that he loved.
Oh no, he didn't like the American system. And I mean, I think what happened after Citizen Kane, and still having difficulty trying to convince studios to sort of give him total control after he created such a masterpiece. I mean, at the time, Citizen Kane didn't sort of make a huge amount of money. I mean, it grew in stature as years went by. That's a very rare thing for a film. But his personality and his incredible grasp of just about everything meant that when he went to do a radio series called War of the Worlds, he panicked America.
He was a brilliantly, you know, imaginative and theatrical and dramatic character, wasn't he? Mm. Completely unique, his imagination.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the thing is about Citizen Kane, as we just said, you know, when it was released, I mean, Hearst, you know...
Well, yes, of course.
He tried to suppress
it.
I don't think it was properly released... And as a result, it got a sort of bum rap, as it were, in terms of money. And as you know, Hollywood is completely, all they ever look at, you know, the numbers as to whether the film made money or not.
Mm.
But, so I think he was unlucky in that respect.
Well, I have to say that I'm very envious of your time with a man of such stature, and, of course, somebody who, being in the film school there and all everybody talking about Orson Welles. I mean, did you ever sort of go back and contact any of your previous...
I do have a big mate, in fact, who lives in America now.
Mm-hmm.
He was American, and later on he became a congressman and did very well, ran for the Senate, and now he's become a writer himself.
Mm.
But we do compare notes about the London School of Film Technique.
Good. Good, that's nice to hear.
I hope you weren't there. I have to be.
No. I wasn't there, but I do remember it very, very vaguely from my youth.
I think it's called the London Film School.
Film School now, yes, that's correct.
Subsequently, you know, when I left university, as you know, late 60s, you know, if you said you wanted to go into the film industry, it would really laugh in your face. And there was no such thing as, you know, nowadays, you know, the Bournemouth University has a course of film, and a lot of universities have film courses, don't they?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As well as there's a National Film School and the London School of Film Technique. So there are lots of places now for young guys, you know, who want to go into that industry, which of course is a very big industry.
Yes, well, I think the raw talent back in that day, you had to have that raw talent, whether it's a director, as an actor, or as a technician, to actually get into the industry. I mean, I'm not saying it's easier today, but there's a lot more opportunity today.
Yes. And of course, it was, I think I put it in the book, it was also very much a family business in terms of the technicians.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, my dad was a cameraman, my granddad was a cameraman, so that's how it happened quite a bit. And I had no connections that were into the industry.
Mm.
And one of the things, sorry, I'm rabbiting now, but
please.
One of the things about working with him was that he was a little bit a man apart, and so, you know, when I started working with him, I was full of hope that I'd meet all these people, which I did, of course, and work with them, and so on and so on. But I began to realize after a few months that he was sort of isolated, and therefore I was isolated because I was his sidekick, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. I would love to talk hours about this with you, Dorian, I have
no,
to be honest.
Will. Well, maybe where are you in Malaga?
We are actually in the Malaga area. It's a place just past Puerto Banús, Marbella, called San Pedro. Where we're based, so it is on the Costa del Sol. That's the main thing.
I've made lots of commercials down your way.
Well, talking of commercials, I thought we'd go out. Do you remember Orson Welles and the classic Flinders Frozen Peas voiceover session?
Yes, the voiceover thing. Yes.
To give our listeners a flavour of his let me put it this way,
well done.
His determination to actually make something sound really perfect in front of adversity with not quite so intelligent producers or directors, I'll be honest about it. I mean, I think it's a classic.
Brilliant.
Dorian, thank you so much for your time, Dorian Bond, and just give us the title of the book again.
Yes, it's called Me and Mr. Welles.
That's the one.
Traveling Europe with a Hollywood Legend. It's a fun book. It's something that people can read on holiday or you know, and learn a lot from it and laugh occasionally and occasionally even be moved, hopefully.
Well, me and Miss Wells, I'll give you more details about that after we've had a listen to this. Dorian Bond, thank you so much for joining us. Stay on the line if you want to have a listen.
Thank you.
We know a remote farm in Lincolnshire where Mrs. Buckley lives. Every July, peas grow there. Do you really mean that?
Thank you. I'd start half a second late.
Don't you think you really want to say July over the snow? Isn't that the fun of it?
If you make it almost when that shot disappears, it'll make my...
I think it's so nice that you see a snow-covered field and say every July peas grow there. We know a remote farm in Lincolnshire where Mrs. Buckley lives. Every July, peas grow there. We aren't even in the fields, you see.
Yeah, we aren't.
We're talking about them growing and she's picked them.
Yeah.
On what?
In July.
I don't understand you. What must be over for July?
When we get out of that snowy field.
When I was out, we were onto a can of peas, a big dish of peas, when I said in July.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, always.
In July, really.
I'm always past that.
You are?
Yes. Okay. Well, that's about where I say in July.
Could you emphasize a bit in July?
Why? That doesn't make any sense. Sorry. There's no known way of saying an English sentence in which you begin a sentence with in and emphasize it. Get me a jury and show me how you can say in July, and that's just idiotic, if you'll forgive me by saying so. That's just stupid. In July. I'd love to know how you emphasize in and in July. Impossible. Meaningless.
I think all they were thinking about was that they didn't want to...
He isn't thinking.
Wilson, can we just do one last...
Yeah?
And it was my fault. I said in July. If you can leave every July...
You didn't say it. He said it.
It's every July.
Your friend. Every July?
So after this show...
No, you don't really mean every July.
It is. That's
but that's
case.
That's no. Bad copy. It's in July. Of course it's every July. There's too much directing around here.
Could I have one more go, Wilson, please? Sorry.
Norway. Fish fingers, Findus, Norway. We know a certain fjord in Norway, near where the cod gather in great shoals. There, Jan Stangeland. Shit.
A fraction more on that shoals thing, because you roll it around very nicely.
Yeah, roll it around, and I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against. Because it's full of things that are only correct because they're grammatical, but they're tough on the ear. You see, this is a very wearying one. It's unpleasant to read. Unrewarding.